Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 16, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. We welcome to today's call two panelists, one of whom, David F. Barton, is a partner at the Gardner Law Firm, and he is the lead attorney in a case challenging racial preferences at the Small Business Administration. We're also joined by Mr. Roger Clegg. He's president and general counsel at the Center for Equal Opportunity. Mr. Clegg's going to give us some brief background remarks first on the state of law in this area. Then we're going to hear from Mr. Barton about his case. And then we'll revert to Roger Clegg for further comments and maybe a few questions. But as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions, so please do be ready with those questions when we come to that moment. With that, Mr. Clegg, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thank you for holding this teleforum. I'm really not going to speak for very long at all because I think that the audience will benefit most from hearing from David Barton, who has done great work in this area and who has an exciting, relatively new case to tell you about that he's going to be litigating in the next few weeks. One would think, in some ways, that it's surprising that the issue of government racial and ethnic preferences in its contracting is still a live issue. There have been two landmark decisions in this area by the Supreme Court, both of which were quite hostile to the use of such preferences. The first, in 1989, struck down a contracting program that used preferences like that by the city of Richmond, and Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion there. And then 6 years later, in the Adirond case, the government was likewise hostile to a federal government Department of Transportation program. Once again, Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion. But as was her wont, Justice O'Connor, while not liking racial and ethnic preferences, was willing to leave the door open to them. And that's the short answer for why it is that this continues to be a problem. The court has made clear that racial preferences in this area are allowed only if they can withstand strict scrutiny. The compelling interest in this area can only be that the use of preferences is somehow or other needed to remedy discrimination. You don't have a diversity justification or anything like that here. You know, there's no particular racial or ethnic perspective on how best to fill a pothole that the government can assert. So it has to claim that there is some kind of remedial justification for these programs. And this has led to the burgeoning industry of disparity studies, which are used to try to justify the use of these preferences. With that, you know, basic background, I'm going to turn things over to David. I will note for the audience that in our own nod to diversity, we have one older white male from San Antonio, Texas, and then another older white male who was born in Odessa. That's me. The San Antonio guy is David. David, go ahead and take it away.
Hi, this is David Barton. I'm with the Gardner Law Firm in San Antonio, Texas, and been working in this area of the law since 1998 with some success, luckily, and hopefully have some success with the current case. It's the same client in the primary cases challenging the federal government procurement preference program. And what is at issue here, and what I'm going to use is the Dynalantic case introduction on the statutory and regulatory background. I'm not going to do the whole thing because it's almost 10 pages, but some of it is important before I even give preparatory comments on this case and in the prior case. But for those of you who haven't been in it, and that's who this is primarily for, and it'll be boring for the people who have been there because it's not going to be anything new to the ones working in this area. But the Section 8A program is a business development program for small businesses owned by individuals who are both socially and economically disadvantaged. And 15 U.S.C. 637, which is the small business program, and 637A is the 8A program, and that's where it gets its name of 8A from the section of the statute. But small businesses owned and controlled by individuals who are both socially and economically disadvantaged may apply to the SBA, and if admitted into the program, are eligible to receive technological, financial, and practical assistance, as well as support through preferential awards of the government contracts. And the preferential awards are the primary focus, but the others are also important because they do provide specific preferences to these same minority contractors that others don't have. They aren't necessarily relevant or necessary to talk about here today, but the parties agree that DOD presently participates in the 8A program, and we have filed suit against DOD and SBA for the program in the current Rothy case. In order for a firm to participate in 8A, the SBA must certify that the firm is a small disadvantaged business. And that's an important issue in this because small disadvantaged business has certain criteria in it. There's another program called the Minority Business Enterprises Program that Department of Transportation uses that has a different framework, and as is relevant to this case, is totally different than the SBA 8A program. But a business qualifies as small if it meets the standards set forth in 13 CFR Part 121, and that's primarily you go to the NAICS codes, the North American Industrial Classification System, and check the different business, the different numbers for the types of businesses in there, and it lays out by people and dollar amounts what's small, and you have to qualify as small first, and then you qualify as small disadvantage. My client, Rothy Development, is small, and that's important in this case because it develops or it bids in an area of businesses that are also small for the most part because, you know, it's just hard to, for a small business that has less than, let's just use $35 million and the different NAICS codes. In this case, it goes down to, I think, $17 million is probably the lowest that my client's in, but you can get all the way down to $7.5 million, and I've never dealt with anybody at a lower level than that. I think there are some other businesses, but those are the small businesses, and those are the people that Rothy Development competes against, and if they're competing in that framework, they're having to deal with contracts that are set aside exclusively for the socially and economically disadvantaged businesses, and they don't even have a chance to bid on them. So they're cut out of a lot of contracts. Socially disadvantaged individuals are persons who have been subjected to racial and ethnic prejudice or cultural bias within American society because of their identities as members of groups without regard to their individual qualities, and both of those groups and individual qualities are important in this case because constitutional rights inure to the individuals, and one of the things that the government has done in these preferential programs is to stigmatize the groups that are presumed to be socially and economically disadvantaged, and I'll hit on that in a minute also. But just going on, the social disadvantage must stem from circumstances beyond the control of the individual. Economically disadvantaged individuals are those socially disadvantaged individuals whose ability to compete in the free enterprise system has been impaired due to diminished capital credit opportunities as compared to others in the same or similar line of business who are not socially disadvantaged. Individuals who are members of certain racial and ethnic groups are presumptively socially disadvantaged. And let's see. So finding that the socially disadvantaged persons include members of certain groups that have suffered the effects of discriminatory practices, and that such groups include but are not limited to Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, Indian tribes, Asian Pacific Americans, Native Hawaiian organizations, and then there's a whole list of other single countries like Tuvalu and Kiribati and so on that have petitioned to the SBA to be presumptively socially disadvantaged, which is a big move because that means that they don't have to make any separate showing that they're disadvantaged. Like white people can qualify for the program, but they have a much higher burden. Plus, they have some burden at all, and that, of course, is one of the things that we object to, is that there should not be a presumption. And that's what Rothy is challenging in this case, is the presumption that these groups that I just mentioned are socially disadvantaged. Then they do have to show that they're economically disadvantaged. This was another larger issue previously than it is now, but it's still is a big issue that all you have to show is that your net worth is $250,000 or less, and that excludes your ownership in the business and your equity and in a personal residence, which if you keep up with economic statistics, there are very few people, especially small business people, that have $250,000. So essentially that just throws all small businesses who are presumptively socially disadvantaged into eligibility for the 8A program. Then the next item, in addition to that, is that, and this is another part of the challenge in this case, what we're challenging is the definition of social disadvantage, and these are the primary issues, the definition of social disadvantage, the presumption, and then they have a goal. And as I said in Dynalantic, Congress has established an aspirational goal for procurement from socially and economically disadvantaged individuals, which includes, but is not limited to the 8A program, of 5% of procurement dollars government-wide. So they've got that set aside, and that's the easiest thing for a court to grasp onto, to say that, well, this is just an aspirational goal, and they may or may not meet it, and there's nothing that requires them to meet it. However, there is language in the statute that says that that contracting officers will be graded on whether they meet the goals. So you can imagine the impetus that puts on anybody to do that. And then another issue is, although they stay a little bit below that 5% goal for just the 8A people, when you combine the 8As, which that's the special program, that's the certification that they're socially and economically disadvantaged, with other SDBs, which are socially disadvantaged small businesses, and they aren't certified. They can self-certify on their paperwork. They would not qualify for the 8A program unless they got some special dispensation or for an 8A set-aside contract, but they do get, the contracting officers get points for giving contracts to SDBs, and that's a 3% goal, and this is one of the issues that we mentioned in our brief. when you put the SDBs and the 8As together, the 5 and the 3, you get 8. And the government has consistently, over the last few years, hit that goal at 7.99, which is kind of amazing when they say, well, we really don't look at the goal. You know, we just try to, whenever we have the opportunity, give the award to an 8A or an SDB. Well, it's amazing how they come that close consistently is one of our arguments. That kind of gives the background of what the statutory and regulatory requirement is. There's a whole lot of other things that you can either get in the Dynalantic case or if you can pull up the briefs in this current Rothy case. But going back with Rothy, in 1998, Rothy filed the same kind of action against 10 U.S.C. 2323, which is called, because the section of the statute was 1207, is either called the 1207 program or it was called the 2323 program. It was pretty much the same program as the 8A, but it was a little narrower in its scope, and the proof issues at that time were probably more advantageous to file against that with the expectation that they used the 8A for the preference program in 10 U.S.C. 2323. So it was the same factual scenario as what Dynalantic was dealing with back at that same time with their case in the district court against the 8A program. And there was a lot of different factual issues related to that, but probably the primary one was at that time that Congress had before it only 7 disparity studies which showed the statistical information and also had some anecdotal information in it, but that was not the primary part. It was the statistical information that after Adderan, in order to win these cases, you had to show that there was a violation of strict scrutiny. And part of that required statistical support by Congress prior to the implementation of the program. We won because that the court trusted that the statistical information that they used was not adequate. There were a couple of other reasons that played into it. But the relevant one here now is the statistical evidence. So we won that case, finding 2323 unconstitutional in 2008. The Dynalantic case was going at that time, and Rothy was still suffering because the 8A was the all-encompassing case. Getting 2323 out of the way was very good, especially at the subcontracting level and especially in some other areas that preferences that were given to minorities that Rothy regarded as particularly detrimental to their ability to compete on a level playing field. So after we won that, we kind of anticipated, and in fact there was a congressional report that came out that said it was likely that the 8A program would be found unconstitutional because it was essentially based on the same evidence that we had. The government never went back and reviewed that. It doesn't make any difference right now. But for a couple of years, Rothy went along thinking, well, you know, I'm still suffering at the preferences that are given and not being able to compete for contracts, and it just kept getting worse and worse. And finally in 2012 they came back and said, you know, we have to do something, we have to file. So we filed in 2012. At that time the Dynalantic court was, the decision in the Dynalantic court was being held up by the judge, and one of the reasons that we filed then was to either get the judge to move on it or to join our case with that and just, you know, add some more power to the Dynalantic case. The judge came out shortly thereafter and decided against Dynalantic. But what had happened is the Dynalytic judge, after 2008, had allowed the government to supplement the record, and the government supplemented it with 70 or so new disparity studies with statistical evidence in it. And those disparity studies, according to our assertion, were just more or less dumped on Congress. You know, they were never analyzed. There were no significant deliberations in which they made a complete finding that that those statistics supported that there was implication of discrimination in government contracting. Those same documents were used in the transportation program, which at that time, I think we were operating under ICE-T, is what it was called, whatever the statutory numbers are in it. That was the way the program was referred to. But it was a different kind of program because it was set up mostly on a state and local level, where you had to do a disparity study wherein you wanted to implement the preferences that would apply to transportation work. And when you say transportation work, that's anything that you can imagine that DOT does. So it wasn't just building highways and so on. It could be sodding or whatever, like Adirond was a guardrail and siding company, I think. But after Dynalytic was decided, we asked to be joined in that, and the judge held that in abeyance, but we did get a decision out of Dynalytic, and the decision was, we would say, completely wrong, because the primary guidance for the decision from the court was that post-enactment evidence, in other words, these statistical studies, disparity studies, could be entered at any time. Well, one thing, the transportation program has been reauthorized numerous times since 1978, so it was legitimate in the transportation program, where there are minority business enterprises, MBEs, that you could say those statistics actually applied to what Congress did for the transportation program, but they never cross-pollinated that to the 8A program, nor did they have hearings on the 8A program, which is a much wider focus because it's in all federal agencies. All federal agencies can impose those preferences as opposed to just the Department of Transportation, and it's where Department of Transportation dollars go. So, it would be a state transportation agency that has a statistical study. But after that decision came out, then we were on our own, and what the government did with their expert is they threw in another 32 disparity studies into our case, so we have 107 disparity studies, 32 of which, I think it's 32, it may have been 35, have never even been seen by Congress. They were just thrown in as societal discrimination, essentially, to show that there was systemic discrimination against these five groups, really without any real definition or specific application to those groups. But even more so, most all of these statistical studies lump together different industries, and the NAICS codes have six different levels. They start at the two-digit level, which is construction, and then they go to the three-digit level, which divides it down more, and you can look in, all you have to do is go online and look at North American Industrial Classification System and see how those are broken down. But they go out to six digits, and six digits is actually where businesses do their business, like a photographer, a special photographer of some kind or other. But special photographers at the three-digit level are lumped together with photographers, possibly food service, janitors, et cetera, so you really don't know where that discrimination exists specifically in order to protect the constitutional rights of individuals and individual businesses. And that's one of the biggest bugaboos of ours is that, and of course you have to, once you determine that you have a statistical basis, then you have to narrowly tailor your program to the specific areas. In other words, you would have to, in the Dynalantic case, they made an as-applied unconstitutional finding as to military simulators. What Dynalantic did was, I think it was submarine simulators. And that's a six-digit code. Well, the judge said it's facially constitutional, but then in the same breath he says, but they never made any findings as to this particular industry, which our argument is they've never made any findings as to any particular industry. So his decision in that case was a contradiction in terms. That has to do with the NAICS codes, but he also allowed all of this post-enactment evidence for 8As, and that post-enactment evidence, for one thing, almost every one of, and there were probably only a couple in there, that did not, the disparity studies were all prepared for transportation program preferences, and that program is even completely different. So you've got statistics that were gathered for a different program under different auspices and statutes and everything else, plus it's post-enactment evidence to 1978 and 1988 for the 8A program. And then the other was, the judge in that case said that the Salerno decision applied, that said you have to prove that there's not any circumstance under which the statute could be found constitutional. And that Salerno one is old law. The Supreme Court, since before and since the time of the Dynalantic case, has said that Salerno is not good law for equal protection claims of constitutionality. And there will be, you'll see somebody, one of the cases that, and I can't even think of the name right now, but challenges, and Salerno itself challenges something that is not an equal protection claim in the sense of what the challenge to the 8A program is. So it was, we would say that it's not a relevant decision even in and of itself. But certainly the having to prove that there is no way that any part of the statute could be found constitutional is not a strict scrutiny standard. So that's kind of it. And I'll let Roger relate that and see how we can get moving on questions.
Well, thanks very much, David. And again, we really appreciate your making time to talk to us today. As I recall, you're going to be in court next week, right, arguing the case, and we wish you luck there.
One thing I would like to add,
sure,
the people who don't practice in this area, is that Dynalantic, of course, lost that case. They did file an appeal, and the government settled the case by paying attorneys' fees up to that point and granting Dynalantic free rein in the simulator industry. In other words, no 8A does not apply to the simulator industry anymore. And of course, SBA can make those decisions because that was delegated to SBA, which that's another issue that we have in this, claiming that Congress delegated something, gave no to the executive, gave no guidance, and strict scrutiny is an issue that has to be dealt with by Congress. But anyway, after Dynalantic lost, filed their appeal, the government settled and paid them off. And that's where we are right now. And, of course, my logical argument in this would be they wouldn't have paid them off if they didn't know they were going to lose. And I don't think they'll get that in our case because we need to get, you know, we need to get this thing, get rid of it.
Well, I agree. And, you know, the problem, though, David, with government defendants in this area, and, of course, you know, typically is government defendants, is that they have very deep pockets, particularly when you're talking about the federal government. So no matter what you require the government to do in terms of, you know, coming up with this or that statistical study, they will find somebody or other at some cost who is willing to put together a study that says, well, yes, you know, we meet the remedial predicate. It's always seemed to me that what we really need in this area is a court decision, you know, ideally a Supreme Court decision that says that, you know, look, even if you can show that there's a history of discrimination, you know, in this area and meet the remedial predicate for the compelling interest prong of strict scrutiny, you're never going to be able to show that the use of racial preferences is narrowly tailored to the remedy, because the contracting area is uniquely amenable to devices that will ensure non-discrimination simply through greater transparency. You know, you require the government to advertise bidding opportunities. Require the government to announce what the low bid was. You know, you can require all kinds of things in terms of, as I said, transparency and outreach. And that's the way to address any kind of discrimination that is purportedly still out there. So, save your money when it comes to doing these disparity studies. It's never going to get you to what you want in terms of it proving that the use of racial preferences is what you need to do. It's the area where, in other words, you can cite Chief Justice Roberts' dictum that the way to stop racial discrimination is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. What's your reaction to that?
Well, of course, that's a quote that we use in every brief that we file. We like that quote, but, you know, it's the truth. And the real difficulty in this case when we found it or when we filed it was the simplicity with how this could be dealt with. And it is our belief, and it's all filed, and for the government attorneys who are on the line listening to this, there's not anything that I'm saying that's not in my briefs and public record, therefore. But when we filed it, we filed objecting to the definition, the presumption, and the goal, and the issue was there was no compelling interest of the government that could be supported by a strong basis and evidence at the time the statute was authorized. And that goes to the heart of Salerno and Adoran and Croson and all of those that have made it clear, and most recently in the Shelby County case last year, that you have to have the evidence before the authorization of the statute. Shelby County was the voting rights challenge to Holder was the defendant in that, and some of their voting rights actions that he was taking. But the simplicity of that is that if you don't have that statistical evidence to support it, you can't have narrow tailoring. Well, one of the biggest fights in these cases, and especially the Rothy case in 2008, was whether the requirements for narrow tailoring were met, such as burden on those who who did not qualify for the program, and there were five different requirements in that. But we fundamentally don't even have to deal with that in our brief, although we did touch on it, because if you don't have a compelling interest based on a strong basis in evidence, then narrow tailoring's not even an issue. And if a court properly found in this case that, in fact, they don't have the statistical basis in evidence, they would say, and we don't need to go to narrow tailoring, and will not address that issue because, you know, they can't have a program.
Very good. Dean, please let me know when we should turn things over to audience questions.
Well, Roger, let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you can indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, David, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Roger, at this point, we have one question. Should we take that, or were you going to two questions pending now? Were you going to ask a follow-up question, or should we turn to the audience, Roger?
Oh, let's go ahead and turn to the audience, and I can, if I need to jump back in, I'm happy to do it.
Okay. Looks like we lost one of our questions, so we have just one question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hello, this is Ralph Casarda from the Pacific Legal Foundation.
Hey, Ralph, how you doing?
Very good, very good. Thank you. So
for the
my
other
question
people,
has.
I'll throw in that Ralph is a great supporter, and of course, Pacific Legal is a think tank and a litigation firm, and Ralph's been very helpful to me. He and Roger Clegg in concert in both Rothy cases.
I should say, David, that PLF has a model brief on its website that addresses some of the issues that we've been talking about here, and people who are interested in challenging programs in their neck of the woods should check out that brief. But go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, well, thank you both very much. This is a great topic. Great presentation. My question is along the lines of transparency and contracting. And is there any resistance, do you know of any resistance on the part of prime contractors or contracting associations to making that bidding process completely transparent at the prime contract to subcontract level so that, you know, you would know if there was a disparity, you would instantly know if it was the result of intentional discrimination or simply the result of someone not submitting the lowest bid?
I haven't seen that specifically. That gets into what you and Roger and I do, and it is extreme, probably beyond the comprehension, and I deal real closely. We're primarily a construction litigation firm here, so we're with ABC, American Builders and Contractors, and AGC, the general contractors, and ASA, the subcontractors. And I say all of that because if I went into them and talked to them in that vernacular, their eyes would gloss over and their mouth would fall open. So, and then in conversation, and usually the chiefs of those outfits, in fact, I can say in San Antonio, all the chiefs of those outfits in San Antonio are very well versed in the 8A program and the additional cost that it puts on them for, you know, when they are forced into hiring 8As in the subcontractor program. They know that the rates are higher, the cost of those bids is higher, for example. But they're all very attuned to the program. But you know what you just said kind of gets that really gets into the grass and is beyond their comprehension. So I don't hear it in those terms. I just hear it in generalized guide. I wish we didn't have to deal with that. You know, we have a special person in our bidding shop that you know, that's a whole salary that we have to spend in order to meet all the requirements.
Yeah, Ralph, I've never, you know, heard anybody explain why the kind of transparency that you suggest would be a problem. And again, that's, to me, seems to be something that a court could point out in finding that there is simply no way that the use of racial preferences are ever going to be narrowly tailored. You know, it's not like university admissions or hiring somebody for a job where there's some, you know, irreducible amount of subjectivity so that you know, you can't say with certainty what, well, this was the best qualified person, why didn't you hire him? Or why didn't you admit this student rather than that student? I mean, you know, in that situation, the defendant's always going to be able to say that, well, you know, we're taken by, you know, how well this person interviewed, or we really liked the extracurricular activities or something like that. You know, here you're submitting, you know, bids to do a fairly specific job, you know, for a particular amount of money. And, you know, you submit the low bid or you don't. I understand, you know, there's some subjectivity here too. You know, if the person has a reputation for doing shoddy work or something like that. But in the vast majority of cases, I would think that transparency is going to take care of you know, any purported discrimination that is being alleged as the reason why we have to have more discrimination.
This is David again. That's an area of particular concern of mine, and it's a concern going both ways, and that is we do have the Civil Rights Act, and if somebody is being discriminated against, they have the right to go file an action under the Civil Rights Act, which there probably hasn't been 10 of those done since it was enacted. And I just throw that out there. I don't know what the number is. It could be significantly greater. But the other side of the coin is that minorities are loath to go ahead and make those claims because they know they might not ever see another subcontract or another teaming agreement or mentor-protege program if somebody knows that they filed that kind of action. But what it goes one step further, and this is the reason I bring it up at all, is that the anecdotal evidence that we get, one, there are very few specific allegations of discrimination upon which Congress made a determination that the anecdotal evidence was adequate. Really, in my world, you should have your anecdotal evidence of people complaining about discrimination. Then you say, okay, well, let's go confirm it with statistical evidence. So you do analytical or anecdotal first and then go to statistical. But the anecdotal tends to be generalized, so you have to have the statistical. But the other thing is that by being generalized, it ends up being societal discrimination, which clearly in all of these cases, Croson, Adoran, Rothy, all of them, you know, societal discrimination, you can't base a race-based program on that because you can't narrowly tailor it.
This is Ralph again. So it seems to me that what the disparity studies are actually measuring is some type of societal discrimination, because they're mixing in, they usually arrive at disparities which they rely on by mixing in data from prime contracts, from subcontracts, and as you pointed out, David, from all different kinds of construction or all different kinds of trades. So doesn't that really measure some type, if it measures anything, doesn't it measure, you know, some type of societal discrimination in general, which the Supreme Court has said cannot be a basis for racial preferences?
Exactly. And of course, that's what your template brief is, and it's what my brief is also, that we first say it's post-enactment evidence, and therefore it can't be used, therefore there's no strong basis in evidence of statistics. to support the program. But then we go one step further to say you couldn't identify where that discrimination was, even if you used those disparity studies. And then what comes next? Experts. And the government can spend $5 million on experts to go out. And as we say with economists all the time, or as economists always tell us, well, what number do you want? And they can get whatever number they want. Well, I've got a small business here that doesn't even clear that much money in profit on a yearly basis. So there's no way that you can compete against the government if you have to get into the numbers game. And that's why, we took the simplistic approach because that should win the case. But then the government in this case puts in experts. We put in experts. And it's difficult to match the level of expertise from the plaintiff's side in these cases. So we feel like we're at a disadvantage. But the thing that I've told the court in my briefs and will be the thing that I start off with, Judge, you don't need to get in to the bushes in this thing with the numbers, because if you follow the law of not being able to use post-enactment evidence, then you never get there, and you aren't going to have to figure out regression analysis and everything else, which this goes to one of the things in the Rothy case that the court says, the Federal Circuit said that the district court had to de novo on its own evaluate all of those disparity studies for their reliability and credibility. Well, there were only 7 studies there, so the court kind of could have done that. In this case, you have 107 studies, and that would require the court to go look at every one of these. And when you get into the regression analysis, which hopefully I'm only going to have to deal with that for about 15 seconds in my brief, you get into that regression analysis, my hopes is I'll be able to make her eyes water. But the thing is that we're in the Dinalanic court at the District of Columbia. So she has the opinion of Judge, this is a new judge, she has the opinion of Judge Sullivan of that court. So the court already has a precedent. And what she's going to have to do is decide, okay, I've got the Shelby County case that's come out since the decision in Dinalanic that tells me I just flat cannot use post-enactment evidence. So I can justifiably disagree with his decision. This is a new judge up against the senior judge of the district court of the District of Columbia. You know, where is she going to go? Common sense tells you she's probably going to follow the senior judge on that court.
Gentlemen, this is Dean breaking in here. We do have another caller with a question to our audience. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. But for now, let's take our next question.
Hi, this is David Tryon in Cleveland. I'm a member of the Ohio Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And 2 years ago, we had hearings on impediments to minorities in small business minorities in contracting and getting business, those type of things. And what I heard mostly was that minorities are having the same types of problems that all small businesses were, especially dealing with governmental regulations in all the things that are involved and also in bidding requirements. But it disproportionately affects minorities because they are, you know, there's more minority small businesses that have, you know, trouble with funding and things like that than there are non-minorities. So it is disproportionate in that way. But there were also some that said, that did tell some anecdotal evidence of where they were specifically discriminated against because of their race or their basically something about their minority status. So I have just a couple of questions that you could address, perhaps. One is, actually, my first question is, what you're doing is, the litigation costs a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars probably to do what you're doing. And most small businesses can't afford to pay a lawyer to do that. So my first question is, how can your clients or my small business clients afford this type of thing? And second of all, where there is legitimate discrimination, you know, what do you think what would be a reasonable remedy to help out those minorities who really are enduring this type of treatment?
Well, Roger will be more than happy to address the race neutral side, that race neutral programs could pick out those individuals that identified, but you need to keep in mind that in order to enact a race-based program this way, Croson and Adirond and Rothy, the issue is it has to be widespread systemic discrimination shown by strong basis in evidence of statistical and anecdotal evidence. So, you know, you could have 100 different people who identify specific things, and unless they can raise that to a level of widespread systemic discrimination, they aren't going to get there. Now to the expense part of it, and this was probably the most irritating thing to me, in the first Rothy case, this is public record because it's in the filings, that cost approximately $1.6 million to try that case. This was a case that the family that owned that business got together on a regular basis to discuss the moral necessity to straighten out what they believed was an egregious constitutional violation of their right to compete on a level playing field, with the hope that maybe they would get EJIA fees at the end of it. That the previous case was exactly like this one. There was never any statistical evidence. The government knew they had to have statistical evidence, and in 1998, at about the same time we filed that action, they started putting together a study group to try to set benchmarks of where the discrimination existed in federal government contracting. They were never able to do that in a credible fashion, and they finally just quit in 2000 and never again did any kind of studies. So there was never any statistical support for the program, just as there is here. So we filed our EJIA claim, and eventually cert was denied at the Supreme Court on that after the district court and the federal circuit. I thought maybe the federal circuit would go along with me because this is another thing I didn't mention. That case went up to the federal circuit three different times, with the judge directing the court the first two times what to do. After the second one, I asked the court to reverse and render because it was clear the judge wasn't going to do it. And I figured that he'd probably send it back. You know, they give him three chances at it. When he sent it back the next time, he still didn't follow their directions, the primary one being that he didn't de novo evaluate the disparity studies. I again asked for reversed and rendered, and that's what I got. So I get a case that from the very beginning had never had any statistical support, a case in which the circuit court finally reverses and renders in it. You know, you can't get any closer to EJIA not substantially justified in defending their position. Their only real position was, we've got an obligation to defend Congress, DOJ, we've got an obligation to defend Congress. And I don't agree with that. But even on the bigger side, when you see all the environmental cases, and this is for the people that don't follow this very closely either, there are times when DOJ pays attorney's fees without even having a request for EJIA fees in environmental cases. And this is the same thing. And they grant almost all of them. I've never looked at what the statistics are, whether it's 100% or 90% or 10%, but I know that practically every case that I see on challenges to EPA rules by National Defense Fund and all the others that you can possibly name, they always get their fees. And I just, that was an egregious constitutional violation in my estimation. But it goes to the cost of this. How can they afford it? And I had a friend here in San Antonio get in touch with me just this week. And he said he's got a client that wants to do it. And I said, they better be committed, you know, because I'm telling you, it's going to be a minimum of $500,000. And that's not counting the experts, depending on how much expert work you need to get into in that. So it's outrageously expensive, and you have to have a special kind of client who's going to do that.
Yeah, I agree, David. You know, it's very depressing. And, you know, David, the questioner, you know, I also think it makes perfect sense to tweak the way that contracting works so that it's friendlier to all small businesses. But, you know, as you say, the problem that minority businesses face are frequently very similar to the problem that, you know, non-minority businesses face. And, you know, the tweaking ought to be done in a way that doesn't favor, you know, one racial group over another. Where you do have discrimination, I think that tweaking the system so that there's greater transparency is a good way to ensure that discrimination doesn't happen. You know, as David pointed out, it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of race in contracting, you know, against minority-owned firms. So that ought to be, if you make it easy to identify such discrimination, that ought to be a pretty good deterrent. But, you know, ultimately, the fact that these cases are so expensive to bring is why I think that we really need some case law that says that you don't have to spend, you know, $1 zillion on your own expert witnesses to show why this very expensive disparity study was defective. You know, you can win simply by showing that even if there is some degree of you know, some evidence of discrimination in the contracting program, racial preferences are not the narrowly tailored way to fight it. I also think that there ought to be more pushback against city councils and state legislatures that enact these programs. That's something that, you know, my organization, the Center for Equal Opportunity, does fairly regularly. Is when we read in a newspaper that a city council is thinking about adopting a program like this, we write to them and say, you know, this is wrong and this is illegal, and if you get sued, you're going to lose. You know, the track record is that state and local governments, especially when they get sued in this area, they lose, and you know, you can be held personally liable. And sometimes those letters work, but you know, sometimes they don't.
Who can be held personally liable, and for what?
Well, the city council members, if you vote for, you know, to adopt a racially discriminatory program, and you know, it doesn't meet the requirements that the Supreme Court has set out in cases like Croson and Natterand, can be held personally liable. There was a case, I think it was out of Miami-Dade County, you know, that held that. There have been some Ohio legislation or cases actually that have held that too. You know, offline if you want, I can send you some, you know, some sites. So you know, it's the classic, you know, black letter law that where a government official violates a clearly established constitutional right, they can be held personally liable.
Thanks very much.
Well, gentlemen, it looks like we've just about exhausted our budgeted time here. I'm going to turn to David Barton for maybe 60 seconds to see if you have a final thought before we adjourn our call.
I think I've pretty well blown everything I can think of.
Well, good enough. Fair enough.
Without
let me thank
really
both.
Getting into weeds, and I hope I've made it clear. I guess that's a good way to finish. I hope I've made it clear that you shouldn't have to get into the weeds of the numbers when you have a situation that we have in the Rothy case where there just was no statistical support from beginning to end.
That's a good place to end today. My thanks to David Barton and to Roger Clegg for an insightful and interesting call. To our audience, our next Teleform conference call is scheduled tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll have a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform discussing the North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners versus FTC case. It's a case argued earlier this week in the Supreme Court that concerns a state regulatory body that is controlled by participants in the market that itself regulates. So that is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.